Welcome to Human Rights Education Now, a podcast series from Human Rights Educators USA. I'm your host, Bill Fernekes, a member of the National Steering Committee of HRE USA, a collaborative network to learn, teach, organize, advocate, and innovate for human rights education in the United States. This podcast aims to raise awareness about human rights education and invites listeners to engage with the worldwide movement to make human rights education the core focus of educational programs from preschool through higher education and in both non-formal and informal community educational settings. This episode concludes our conversation with Maria Hantzopoulos, Professor of Education and Coordinator of Secondary Teacher Certification at Vassar College. Maria discusses how her work with non-governmental organizations has enriched her human rights education scholarship and teaching, the challenges and opportunities for expanding human rights education in public schools, her work in curriculum development, notably in the field of ethnic studies, how human rights education intersects with social justice, the role which human rights education can play in combating authoritarianism, and finally, her recommendations for advancing human rights education into the future. Another dimension of what you've done has been working with non-governmental organizations. So how do you see that related to the advancement of human rights and peace education?
Yeah, so I've worked at various points with different NGOs, and most recently, one of the community partnerships I had was actually with a school, so a little bit different. And but that's where I think, you know, the intersection of how higher ed can sort of work with communities in different ways to inform change is really important. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this project I just did in Poughkeepsie High School with my students about a year and a half ago. And we were really looking at human rights, migration, and the economy. It wasn't originally supposed to be about the economy. It was supposed to be just about human rights and migration. But the teacher we were partnering with said, I really want you to come to my econ class. So if you can make that intersection work, let's do it. And so what we did was she had her curriculum that she had to get the kids to pass these exams, right? These high stakes exams in order to graduate. But what we did is we came in once, we developed this whole curriculum over time, and it was for 6 weeks, and we came in once a week. And it was like nine of us, and really my students led it. I mean, I kind of mentored them, but they each led different pieces, and we did this wonderful, and I can send you the link, unit on human rights, migration, and the economy. And it really worked. And so I think in one way, we were a small intervention into her curriculum, which she really loved, right? Because she could allow for that space and allow us to, it gave legitimacy that we were coming from this college to come in. So, it, you know, her principal loved it, you know, things like that. But we were really able to have these meaningful conversations. And in Poughkeepsie High School, you did have a lot of students who were coming from migrant backgrounds themselves, right? So it was culturally relevant. But there were a lot of kids who didn't have that experience either. But it was, you know, we use the windows and mirrors approach where, you know, it's you're reflecting on your own world, but you're looking to the worlds of others, you know, to really kind of advance these ideas. And those kinds of interventions, I think, are really, really nice ways. We were able to get funding to do that. Just it didn't really cost us much, to be honest, but just to get the transportation, you know, and then have a celebration with the kids at the end, because that's really important as well. But that's an example of a partnership, right, that can actually impact public schools. Sometimes something that's coming from an external body can also be legitimized in some ways by, you know, the school leaders, right? So that's where there might be space. Again, I would argue against anything prescriptive, though, even if it is designed with these contexts in mind. And I'll give you another example. Years ago, I did a collaborative project on teaching about the Middle East and North Africa with a group of other folks. We got funding from the Spencer Foundation. I'm sorry, that wasn't from Spencer. Excuse me, that from the Social Science Research Council and the British Council. And it was this really big project where we looked at all the world history textbooks that were commonly used, not all, four for the month. We kind of did a textbook analysis to look at how the Middle East and North Africa were framed in those textbooks. And then based on that data, we worked with historians and scholars in those fields, not in education, to get sources to develop interventions to those sort of reductive narratives, because they were very reductive narratives. Sometimes not as bad as I thought they were going to be, but in some places they were. But the point was to bring more nuance and complexity in a global history curriculum, right? Which I think does align with the goals of peace and human rights education, right? Even if we weren't directly teaching about human rights or peace. And it was a great project. But I learned, and the whole design of the project was for teachers to drop in, right? Meaning here we came up with, it's not a sequential curriculum. We understand the constraints teachers have, but if they really wanted to hone in on, you know, plural identities in the region, or if they wanted to hone in on political and social movements, you know, that there would be a couple lessons for them to look at, right? I was visiting a school once and someone told me, oh, your curriculum looked great, but my principal made me teach it in a particular way from beginning to end, which wasn't even how it was meant to be designed. And it's all contextualized in the, because it's a website, it's a free website. We put it all up there thinking, what? And, you know, the teacher was like, yeah, it was just really hard to do it that way. And I'm like, that's not how it was meant to be taught. So, you know, things like this can backfire in some ways too, right? Even though the explanations are there. So you need humans to mediate any curriculum anyway. And I think that goes back to what Giroux was saying as well, right? In these contested spaces. So I think it is really important that whatever interventions happen, that the folks on the ground involved are still involved, right? It's not just coming in from the outside. So going back to the Poughkeepsie High School experience I just told you about, the teacher was really involved in that curriculum as well. Like, we developed it, but we would send her copies of our lessons. She'd give us feedback, you know. And so then when we went in, we were even debriefing. And in fact, we all just presented at a conference in California about it, the teacher included, and my former students. So it was great. It was a real partnership, right? So we were trying to break down those hierarchies as well. So I think that has to be embedded in there. Sorry, that was long-winded.
No, it's fine. I wanted to take that further, though, because you've done a lot of work dealing with minority communities and ethnic studies. Mm-hmm. And we know from demographic data that children of color are going to be they're the most rapidly growing population in the public schools nationwide. Yep. So how do you deploy HRE and peace education to try to deal with their needs? Because many of those students, as you know, that come here with either minimal education or their education has been disrupted. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when developing curriculum around critical ethnic studies, and I just worked on this much larger project, I mean, one of the intersections, I think, that are connected to dignity and agency, right, is also this approach to culturally relevant curriculum, which isn't exactly what ethnic studies is, because ethnic studies does really intersects in my mind with transformative human rights education and critical peace education, because it is about social change as well. That's really in there. But I think, you know, grounding sort of the stories of communities that have been silenced and marginalized in some ways and amplifying those voices right away is you know, a very important thing for students to become interested in what they're learning, especially if it reflects who they are. Or connects, you know, you also have diversity within a classroom, right? But if it somehow connects to the experiences that your own community might have had, even if it's distinct, right? So I think there's an inherent connection for me always. And again, when I talked about my own experiences teaching and how I kind of came into this in a backwards type way, we certainly were doing critical ethnic studies at that time as well in the school where I worked. But in terms of addressing like the skills, right? And this is always the tension, right? So, you know, someone comes in with interrupted schooling, or they might, you know, the dominant language being used, it's not a bilingual classroom, it's not a dual language classroom, is not the language that they speak. When we did our project in Poughkeepsie High School, for instance, what was great was we had several students, there were some migrant students in the class, and they were all Spanish speaking. And we were able to have people stationed at each table to kind of we translated everything. We had the material, you know, we allowed them to ask questions, you know, we kind of worked with them where they were. Again, that was a luxury of resources, I'll be honest, because we were like 9 people coming in and we had that, and that's not always the case. But I think that also speaks to a larger issue of how schools in the U.S. are just so, I mean, there's many schools, schools in low-income communities of color are just underfunded, right? And so another piece, I think, of human rights education and peace education is addressing that structural violence in our own society and the United States as well. So you kind of can't separate these things. But ethnic studies itself, I think, lends itself really naturally as an intersection to peace and human rights education. And in our book, we do have this chart where we talk about how these things all connect as well, you know, and then connect to critical consciousness. So
now the word or the term social justice is used rather widely. Yeah. And in HRE USA, and I'm sure in other communities, there's been a lot of discussion about issues of race, ethnicity, culture, and how human rights education does or does not interface with these concepts of social justice. What's your understanding of how you conceptualize it?
Conceptualize social justice?
Or the connection between human rights education and social justice.
Right. So I think if we're looking at the more, so if the field in my mind has shifted more towards the transformative human rights approaches that Felisa Tippetts writes about, and others, and also in peace education, you know, critical peace education, again, that center critical consciousness, that center agency as key concepts, as well as this push for these decolonial approaches, both in peace ed and human rights ed. I think the fields are moving from when I first entered the field in like 2002, when I was a student, where it was a little bit more normative. So again, I think those approaches definitely take up concepts, you know, cultural rights, race, all of that stuff. And even the universal, even in its most normative framework, right, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights does take up those concepts as well. So I think, to me, I think it's there if you're employing this kind of more using this transformative agency as a key piece of the human rights work that you're doing, right? Because it centers people's own personal experiences or their community experiences. So that does tie to racial, ethnic, cultural backgrounds, class backgrounds, whatever it is, right, to sort of transform those social worlds. So I don't see it as separate. But I do think in sort of the more normative or dominant universal type language of human rights, people do evade those topics for sure. But I think these pushes towards transformative human rights education, towards decolonial approaches, really open up new terrain for us to kind of make those connections a little bit more solidified, actually. So I think that's very exciting. And we're at this interesting turning point, in my opinion, of human rights education. I think another piece in the U.S., we don't talk about human rights that much as a discourse in education, as in other countries where it's in their Ministry of Education description, some, even if they're not doing it, right? Human rights is mentioned. I mean, but I also think connecting racial movements like the civil rights movement as a human rights movement is really, really important, right? Connecting Black Lives Matter, right? Connecting abolitionist movements to these are human rights movements, right? It's about the inherent dignity of all people, right? So I think in all communities. So I think those connections just need to be forged in those particular ways. And again, it's not something that's often taken up in U.S. Schools so much, but there's a lot of potential for that connection to be made. And I think that allows for more linkages to sort of global struggles as well.
Well, you're hitting on a very important issue, I think, because in the public discourse in this country, there's a vacuum in the use of the term human rights. I mean, read the New York Times or Washington Post, or you won't find the term very much. Particularly in the headlines, you won't find it. And most Americans, I would argue, well, we know from survey results that they don't know much about the Universal Declaration. But at the same time, they conceive of specific, for lack of a better term, siloed struggles. There's women's rights, there's LGBTQ rights, there's civil rights, but they don't make the connection that this is under the much broader framework. Right. Do you see that too?
I do. But again, I think in general, yes. But I think, I actually think that's why the UN, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a framework is something really interesting to look at with young people, because, you know, we know it's unfulfilled in so many ways, in so many different contexts and places, but it's really a nice grounding tool to even contest some of the things that are said as well, but to also get on a local level to get the kids thinking about, you know, how these rights intersect for them. So I'm going back to this Poughkeepsie project because it was so recent. In one of the classes, when we were looking at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it seems like a very mundane example, but they had just found out, and this was in the COVID context, like the school had come out of COVID, but it was still, everyone had to be back in person. So this was in 2002, the school year of 2022. And they just announced, the school district, that they were going to cut into their vacation break, the one they have in the spring, to make up for learning loss, you know, because of school cancellations, because of COVID or absences. And the students were really, really upset, understandably, right? They found it a week before. They thought they had the week off, and now they had to come in for 3 days, which didn't really seem fair. And that day we were looking at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and one of the students said, wait a minute, is it Article 24? I can't remember off the top of my head, maybe Article 26, the right to rest and leisure, right? And that student was like, they're taking this right away from this, right? We're entitled to this break next week, and they're taking this away from us. That student went to the school board meeting that night and used that document to talk about why what they were doing was wrong and unfair. Of course, the teachers were really upset too. That was their break. You know, it was all of those things. But that's like a small moment where you take this document and you make it relevant to your life in that particular context, which I think can really open up so much. So yeah, I just think it's not integrated. So, you know, one thing needs to happen, I think, in schools, and while I'm not really into top-down policy so much, but I think there needs to be more explicit connections made between human rights language and what's happening in schools, particularly in a social studies curriculum, but not even entirely in that, right? So that discourse is important.
Well, it also deals with the culture of a school, discipline policies, the whole emphasis on human dignity. I mean, one of the interesting issues for me is, what are the other institutions who need to be educated? I would argue journalists, law enforcement.
Yep.
You know, I think those are areas we tend to talk a lot about schooling, but there's also other educational spaces where human rights education can have a lot of value.
100%. 100%. And I think we're at this particular moment in time. You know, if we think about how the fields are changing, and I talked about the transformative and decolonial approaches, we're also at this moment where that I think can really shape the fields, where social media is playing a huge role in sort of confronting what mainstream media, which is often a function of, you know, state sanctioned media, really, right? Even in free societies, connected to sort of corporate entities as well. But the role of social media right now in uncovering truths and injustices and bringing awareness to certain issues is really, really, it opens up so much. It is opening up so much possibility, I think, for education and consciousness shifting as well. But I completely agree with you. And I think that's one thing that we're confronting right now is sort of the mechanisms of control that are coming from so many different institutions right now.
So I'm going to turn to our last set of questions, which I use in every interview. And the first one is this: who would be the most influential role model for your work in human rights education?
You know, I can't really say there's a single individual, because it really does depend on the day. And I'm not saying this as a cop-out. Like, it's hard for me to sort of conceptualize, you know, the struggle for human rights to one person, because I think most advances in human rights and social justice have really been born out of collective movements. And sometimes you get a leader that is is amplified, which is great because it brings a voice, but there's so many people behind the scenes that are or have been for so long. So it's really hard for me to give you, I'm sorry, a person. There's so many people and there's so many different movements. But I'm going to think about an arc, right? When I think about where we are today in the United States, and, you know, some of the original sins of the birthing of this nation state, including enslavement, for one example, you know, you had all of the abolitionists originally coming from enslaved people, you know, the enslaved folks who were abolitionists kind of risking their lives, but then raising awareness so that folks from the dominant culture could also sort of engage in abolitionist work. And then we had the civil rights movement, and we're still, it's still an arc, right? We're discussing reparations now, right? Still not that collectively, like I'm inspired, even though it's a long arc, right? Of possibilities of really, really breaking down these oppressive institutions. And that's just like one example. So all the folks, I mean, we have the leaders, we know who they are, but we have all the folks on the ground that have done so much to kind of amplify these perspectives. I'm thinking in this current moment, you know, you talked about journalism, the journalists in on the ground in Gaza right now who are really risking everything to get the stories out when international press isn't allowed in. I know CNN was allowed in for the first time yesterday, but, you know, 2.5 months into this, risking their lives, we've seen when we've seen so many journalists that have been killed, wounded, missing. But, you know, the folks that are there on the ground getting their stories out through social media, actually, you know, is really, really inspiring. They're, you know, I guess at this point, they're risking their lives to show what's happening, but, you know, they feel they have no choice, right? So I would, you know, say that the folks like Motaz, Aziza, Plestia, Alakad, who did get out, Bisan Wizard, you know, they're really inspiring right now in terms of just being models for what it takes, you know, to sort of raise awareness on these issues so that we can change them. Hopefully.
Okay,
I mean, that's looking very bleak. Sorry, I don't mean to go down that road.
That's fine. So number two, what quote most effectively sums up your view of the importance of human rights?
Well, yeah, I thought about this for a minute because I'm like, the importance of human rights. I think there's a quote from Mandela that I think is, you know, not that is that speaks to the importance of why we need human rights. It's because when you deny, he says something like, when you deny people their human rights, to deny people their human rights is to challenge their very humanity, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we believe in human life as sacrosanct and sacred, you know, we need to talk about human rights, right? Because so many people are denied their humanity. So I think that really speaks to me. Again, there are so many, there are other quotes that talk about change and collectivity mm-hmm. and solidarity that are beautiful too. Yeah, I was torn between that one and, you know, but I think that speaks to the importance of human rights.
And so lastly, if you had the power to make one critical change to advance human rights education in the United States, what would you do?
Well, I think what I mentioned before was intentionally, because there is so little human rights discourse in the U.S. vernacular in schools, but like you said, in other places, I think intentionally using those frameworks in policy so it filters down into practice would actually be really, really helpful. But probably the most critical changes too would be to reverse some of the rigid policies that have really started to shape the American educational system. We talked about this and they intersect with policing actually as well, but you know, the zero tolerance policies, the overemphasis on high stakes testing, all these things that create degrading environments for young people that almost prohibit their rights in some ways also probably need to be abolished as well. So those were two. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Two changes.
I'll throw in censorship and academic freedom issues.
Well, yes, that is all part of it. And, you know, I think you were asking earlier and I went off on a different tangent, but just thinking about, you know, it's a double-edged sword right now, right? People are resisting. People are speaking. And there's more censorship sort of coming down at the same time. And this is what we see in authoritarian societies, right? Like it's this double-edged sword. They double down when things start to kind of shift, right? When structures are really being challenged. So on the one hand, you're seeing more questioning of narratives. And on the other hand, you're seeing more legislation that's coming down. And really what's being discussed right now is pretty scary in terms of it just being almost McCarthy-ish in the United States right now. But I have hope, right? You got to have hope. Cornel West talks about that a little bit too, how it's not optimism necessarily, but it's hope. It's almost like, you know, and if we go back to those long arcs towards justice, right? It's incremental, but it's, but you know, it does happen. So.
Well, Maria, I've enjoyed our conversation today tremendously, and I hope you have.
I have. I want to thank you so much. And it was great to be in conversation with you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Human Rights Education Now. You can find additional information about this podcast series at www.hreusa.org. Each episode is available on the HRE USA podcast page, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Player FM, and Deezer. They will soon be available on YouTube and SoundCloud. You can also download each episode as an MP3 file. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, send them to Christy@HREUSA.org. That's KRISTI@HREUSA.org. Our podcast team includes host and producer Bill Fernikes, executive producer Christy Redelius-Palmer, editor Elizabeth Schwab, sound designer and project manager Sabrina Sanchez, communications and public outreach coordinator Jessica Terbruggen, and production coordinator Jasmine Chizu Gota. The Human Rights Education Now logo was designed by Kim Behring. Human Rights Education Now is a production of Human Rights Educators USA, a project of the Center for Transformative Action in Ithaca, New York.